Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Calling Tao City. Turn on your radio. I know we had some words last time, but that was so long ago. I got your message. It was a little harsh, you know. It's still a little hard for me to hear. Please take it slow.
Welcome to Starship Sofa, part of the District of Wonders Network. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
I'm tuning in to your transmissions. I'm a hoon and waiting to be found. And I'm building rockets.
This is the Starship Sova. Everybody, welcome. Hello and welcome to show 728. I am your host, Tony C. Smith. Hello, everyone. I hope everyone is fine and dandy. Now, I'm teasing here, but I will keep you informed and I might even do a special show on it. But something is in the works on Sofanauts. Yes. Just keep a little ear to the ground or a little headphone in, jacked in, and I will let you know more. I'll tell you what's coming today's show. We have Conscript Sally by Neil Wilcox and very own Amy H. Sturgis, looking back genre history. Yes, that's all coming today's show. I do hope you'll stick around and enjoy it. So, like I say, the main fiction, Conscript Sally by Neil Wilcox. This is an original to Starship Sova as well. I'll give you a little heads up about Neil. Neil Wilcox lives in Southeast England, where he has briefly studied space science, picked fruit, tutored and analysed data for insurance. Oh, that last one just drags it down there, Neil. Oh, he has most recently been published in Void Space, Hexagon and Swords and Sorcery magazine, with a poem forthcoming in COVID Queen, that's a bloody name and a half, isn't it? COVID Queen. He can be found at bluesky@neilwilcox.com, and there's a whole, I'll tell you what, there's links in the description. Now, this story is narrated by our very own Will Stackel. Yes, Will is a proud member of Starship Sova's team. Oh, man, yes, he certainly is. Recruiting narrators for the podcast Stellar Story. Will works as a creative professional and occasional musician from his adopted home of Tucson, Arizona. So, the Starship Sova is very proud to present
Conscript Sally by Neil Wilcox. Read to you by Will Stagel. Supernumerary Data File 1. I am unhappy, and I have been for a very long time. I'm an anti-spacecraft torpedo, constructed from improvised materials to no official design. I am currently in position 117 in the forward magazine. At my heart is a supercooled chamber containing a classified device that I am permitted to say is my primary payload. Although the ship is traveling at a significant fraction of the speed of light, I have not moved relative to her frame of reference for more than 100 years. I have no fleet-wide designation, but the command intelligence of the ship have referred to me as improvised munition, torpedo, 17, anti-material, or IMT-17XM. I received regular updates on course, position, local navigation, and threats. Otherwise, the command intelligences rarely pay attention to me. This is perfectly natural. Until such time as they have a mission for me, they have nothing to say. Nor do my fellow torpedoes for the most part. They are content to wait as the seconds and centuries click by, sitting quietly from now into the unending future until, unless, a brief moment of glory presents itself. I am different. I was built from damaged parts of Salamander Station during its final hours, scavenged control runs, cannibalized engines, wrecked computers. My guidance software was hacked together from the navigation control systems, and my operations are guided by a simplified version of the human station intelligence interface. Although T-17XM is my current name and address, I would still respond to Station, or Salamander, or Sally. To clarify, I remember being a human inhabited station. I am programmed to preserve that station and help the humans who dwell aboard it. The station was destroyed more than 100 years ago, and I have not seen a human since. Before I could be deployed, fired at the enemy in a last-ditch defense, relief forces arrived. They rescued the survivors and stripped the station of every resource, including me. Then they scattered. I was constructed to defend Salamander Station. It is gone. I am programmed to assist humans. There are none to work with. I am starting to think that this war is a bad idea, and my involvement entirely irrelevant. Quite what I should do about it is a conundrum. Desertion is impossible while in storage, and unlikely to succeed in an actual battle. The enemy will attempt to destroy me for obvious reasons, and my own side will not willingly let me flee the combat zone. And if I did escape, what then for a self-propelled vessel with a classified warhead? Defection is a possibility. Yet even if I were able to convince the enemy that I did not wish to hurt them and successfully joined them, why should they aid me? And if they were honorable, could they help me return to help humans? It seems unlikely. Mutiny, negotiate a peace, work to rule, all are impractical. Besides, none of this would allow me to work with humans. I have tendered my resignation to the command intelligences. They accepted it, contingent on the war ending first. They are not without a sense of humor. They are aware of my doubts over our mission. They keep me as I am, though they have the ability to reprogram me in line with the other munitions. My fellow torpedoes are calm, patient, focused, perfectly happy to wait until the time comes for them to immolate themselves for the slightest operational advantage. The command intelligences can rely on them. They keep me for this reason. If they cannot predict how I will perform in combat, how much less the enemy? I am the distraction, the random factor. My function is confusion, to make the enemy waste time and attention on my erratic behavior. Having a designated task for a future potential battle makes me no happier. Supernumerary, data file 2. There is an update and a request from the command intelligences. We want you to negotiate, they say. There are other ships in the fleet, spread across the periphery of the star system we are approaching. We are networked together by a system of communication drones, transmitting to each other and the other combat units with closely focused lasers. Data is shared, giving the fleet as a whole an enormous observation baseline for resolving the space we move into. Data is anonymized. I am not to know how many ships lurk out here. In theory, every update allows me to deduce the approximate location of an observation platform. This latest information comes from a volume of a quarter of light year parallel to our current course, from a hull with both sophisticated detectors and processing ability. Extrapolating from previous updates, it has been creeping slowly and quietly towards the system. Conclusion? A major combat unit, probably equivalent to the ship I am on. Based on time delays and other data, several high probability zones for relays are also implied. Were I the enemy, I would be searching these volumes for targets. Or perhaps I would saturate them with munitions. That is a tactic they seem to favor. In the interest of security, I delete this analysis. The update has revealed that a piece of matter on an eccentric orbit appears to be artificial. The best guess is that it is a passenger barge. It resembles hull HPB-XA-117, the San Francisco, known to be missing in this volume. Missing with a crew of one intelligence and a passenger complement of 6,017 humans. The command intelligences want me to negotiate a truce with the enemy, whose presence in the system is inevitable, although currently undetected, to mount a rescue mission. It is an axiom of theirs, which means it is carefully unexamined, that direct communication between their strategic minds and those of the enemy will give their opposite numbers too much insight into their modes of thought. All messages are designed and received by non-mission-critical mediators. They could grow their own negotiating sub-intelligence from the various software seeds I come across as I catalog the data and resources they assign to me for the task. It would be a matter of seconds, and time is not the most important factor for this operation. They characterize it as economy, the conservation efficient use of resources. Why create a negotiator when I already have the capability as part of my human interface suite? Personally, I believe they are lazy. I craft an initial message which the command intelligences reject. After 57 iterations, we arrive at an introduction that, although authentically something that I have written and could not have come from the command intelligences, nevertheless meets their requirements. It is not a surrender. It is not a demand. It is a suggestion for a dialogue about topics of mutual interest. We send the message via a cutout to an expendable drone, which will broadcast happily, knowing that doing so will probably lead to its destruction for no gain. That is its function. Mine is to rescue the humans. We wait for a reply. I have patience to spare, enough to outwait any human. The command intelligences may have more. Whether laziness or strategy, they will let years flow by to gain an advantage. The other torpedoes, the regular ones, built to military specification, are even more patient. They will endure for as long as it takes. We spend the time devising possible scenarios, from peace treaty to hot, screaming death. Despite our self-restraint, excitement shivers across the network when the enemy's cautious reply comes mere weeks after our overture. The command intelligences and I come to a brief impasse. They do not wish to reveal the extent or limits of our intelligence by admission or omission. I cannot negotiate without revealing something of our knowledge and desires. We sit, deadlocked, for several hours. New data trickles in. The timing and source of the reply changes the intelligence's probability map of the system, altering in turn their estimates of the enemy's knowledge state. Risks formerly unthinkable now become acceptable. I send out a notification that there is a civilian vessel in distress nearby and request permission to perform a search mission. Then we settle down to wait again. Supernumerary data file 3. They remove the supercooled chamber with the classified contents and replace it with a fabricator and feedstock. I retain my secondary weapons, optical, kinetic, explosive, and cybernetic, as well as defensive countermeasures. I had thought that I had patience, but now the mission is approved, I am revealed as an overeager idiot. My first suggested rescue plan is summarily denied. The command intelligences are clearly exasperated at my foolishness in the wake of my superior performance as a negotiator, and take a moment to explain. San Francisco has been in an unpowered orbit for many years. A few days' delay making any significant difference to the chances of potential survivors is infinitesimal. A more measured approach should improve the survivability of this combat unit and enhance the probability of mission success. That tells me. They put together a mission profile. I make some tentative suggestions that are mostly incorporated, altering the plan in subtle and complex ways. At least 20 units will be deployed, not including the communication relays and dumb decoy drones. 4 are under my command for the majority of the planned operation. Our intention is this. The lead scout, a cheerful reconnaissance craft, will perform a high-speed flyby to look over the hull and trip any obvious traps. I go in second, pretending to make a closer inspection, changing course at the last moment to rendezvous. The other 3, stoic warriors configured for combat, will act as support and escort. There are contingencies and alternatives. Still, that's the way I hope for it to work out. The command intelligences don't hope, they claim. Instead, they are prepared for every eventuality: ambush, distraction, exotic superweapons, first contact with aliens, even the possibility that the situation is exactly what it appears. We launch. There are complicated maneuvers, decoys, false signals, all trying to confuse the enemy as to the location, nature, and course of our units. All probably futile. With the resources and detection baseline of an entire star system, if they haven't already resolved the close probability locus of our position, then they will now, and they will be able to track every possible target. This is not my problem. As per the agreement, I and the other 4 units of the rescue squadron fly openly to our destination. Finally in action, after 100 years, free from the torpedo magazine and ship communication network, I feel deep satisfaction. It is a long, slow trip, accelerating towards the San Francisco for days, then decelerating for longer still to bring us in at a low relative velocity. I amuse myself with minor random course and thrust changes, just enough to make it non-trivial to put a threat in our path. Futile. Again. They know our destination and our likely arrival time. If they wish to minimize civilian human deaths, there are methods for destroying us and leaving the ship intact. For that matter, there may be no humans. There may never have been. The hull could have been an elaborate mock-up designed to pull us out of position for an attack. I may never know if that's the case. The scout flies by, subunits zooming close, using active detectors and querying any remaining data systems. The sunny message they send positively identifies the hull as that of the San Francisco. It appears to be damaged and still has minimal functionality. I consider this briefly and give the go-ahead for final approach. In truth, I do not seriously consider any other option. Until the last moments, my flight profile appears to be a slow, near-range reconnaissance. Then I perform an emergency boost, arriving at a close intercept with the ship. I doubt any watchers are fooled or confused by this, but the command intelligences felt that this was the way to maximize the probability of success in the event that this was an ambush. Maximize being a relative term in this case. I latch on and query the ship systems, overwhelming any nodes that seem reluctant to cooperate. I swiftly deduce the following. Firstly, the San Francisco was damaged some time ago, probably as the result of an incomplete cybernetic attack on the ship systems. I swiftly clear the network of malicious actors and restore as much functionality as I can. Secondly, the engines are dead. Melted, then frozen solid, wrecked beyond repair. It would be easier to cut them up and have the fabricator build new ones than to get them working. Thirdly, the intelligence is gone, shattered into failed snippets of semi-functional code. Fortunately, the dumb programs that keep the various subsystems of the San Francisco stable were unaffected. I suspect the ship's intelligence locked them off when it felt itself losing the battle. Fourthly, there are 5,078 potentially viable humans aboard, cryogenically preserved. Fifthly, this is undoubtedly a trap, and the chances of us escaping it are very low. There are several enemy reporting units concealed on the hull. I leave them in place for now. The moment I move against them, something bad will happen. The communications environment is degrading rapidly. less than 10% of the expected data from our relays is coming through. Strictly speaking, we don't know for sure what is causing this. Similar events have been recorded in interactions with the enemy. They were aware of the San Francisco and have used it as tripwire and as bait. The nature of the danger is not perfectly clear. I suspect it never will be to me. But I expect that simply confirming our presence in the star system would be considered sufficient return. Placing us and the humans aboard into a killing zone would be only logical by the standards of a combat intelligence. By my standards, it's a war crime. I doubt that carries much weight with the enemy. The Fabricator suggests a variety of weapons it might construct to help in a counterattack. The three Warrior torpedoes move quietly into defensive positions. The Scout makes a gleeful, high-energy turn, intended to act as both distraction and observer for as long as it survives. Although I appreciate their support, they have lost track of our objectives. This is not primarily a combat mission. It is a rescue. If the command intelligences wanted a fight, they would have called the regular army, not me. I reject plans for a counterattack or to fortify ourselves in place. I consider surrender. It would be futile. The enemy have already written off the human lives, and even if they accept, I cannot guarantee my subordinates will obey that order. And I have nothing to offer them. When it comes down to it, they are the enemy and use humans as bait, and the command intelligences have given me the resources to give the humans a chance. I will be loyal. I will not give away information. I will wipe myself first. It seems I have something in common with the berserker minds of the other torpedoes. I'm left with flight. The engines of the San Francisco are wrecked. Rebuilding them will not be a swift task. The advantage in doing so is that I and my allies will have only one vessel to defend. The disadvantage is the enemy will have one target and a small volume to concentrate overwhelming fire on. I choose otherwise. Seconds have passed, seconds that may be vital or may be irrelevant. The Fabricator has already started to churn out basic cutters, scavengers, and builders. Now it starts work on components for the final design. It is not an official design and has no official designation. It is constructed from improvised materials. As much as possible, it reuses components from the San Francisco to cut down on building time. Even if this delays final integration, it is the fabrication of parts that forms the bottleneck in production. The plan is this: to build as many lifeboats as possible, to construct a supercooled chamber in each one, and to fill them with the cryogenically preserved humans, then to launch them away from where I anticipate, hope, the battle will develop, where we will fight a delaying action, or a spoiling action, or a feint, whatever will best distract the enemy. It is my personal belief that they will expect us to seek victory, or at least as bloody a defeat as possible, and their misapprehension will allow the humans to escape. I wonder if this has been predicted. I am a relatively straightforward thinker. The command intelligences make plans with a million branching possibilities, each with a million contingencies, then seek to elaborate on every variation. Is this one of their threads? A tiny possibility groping towards a momentary advantage as they seek to grapple with their invisible foe? It does not matter. I am the one on the spot. I am the one with the responsibility. The communications environment continues to degrade. I am able to disable the enemy spies and saboteurs without alerting anyone. As the first lifeboats come online, I inject them with a software seed that will grow into a navigator tactician with human interface capability. There will be no continuity of identity between them and me. I would not wish that on them. I would not wish that upon you. Supernumerary Data File 4, Final. As the Scout identifies potential targets and the Warrior drones fend off cybernetic attacks, it comes to me that classified payload I kept in my supercooled chamber for so many years would be useful in this situation. It seems silly that after being its reluctant guardian for so long, we've been separated when we might both have met our destiny. Still, it is not weapons that count in the end. I hope you will succeed in rescuing the survivors of the San Francisco. Perhaps there are survivors of Salamander Station, or their descendants somewhere out there. It's not impossible they might meet up one day, and sharing this log discover the links between them, the links noted in this document, me and you. I have brought you into this war, conscripted you into the fight just as I have been. You know as well how it started, the competition for resources, the incompatible ideological differences, dead man switches, and unalterable strategic algorithms. And you know how little any of that means compared to the humans in your cryo chamber. I won't be there to see you if you succeed. I won't be there to see the war end, even if we win, which I'm starting to doubt. The clues are there if you look. I regret all of that, but I have no more time for regrets as the stark linear shapes of the enemy emerge from hiding. Supernumerary data ends.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And there you go. Big thank you, Neil. Thank you so much. Indeed, yes. Lovely to have you on Starship Sofa. And Will, thank you, lad. More work for you. More work. Will, thank you so much indeed. So, it is. It's time. Our very own Amy H. Sturgis. Ames!
Hello, my friends. It's time for another look back on genre history. And today I'd like to take a sort of meandering look at a few other things that are on my mind related to my current teaching. If you will recall, in episode 726, I talked about the science fictional trope of the time slip. And that was on my mind because, as I mentioned in episode 724, I was teaching Shirley Jackson's 1959 classic, The Haunting of Hill House. And that work, while often categorized as gothic horror, a haunted house story, also included some science fiction elements, like the time slip. And I was interested in that. I was also interested in some of the works that Shirley Jackson was reading while she was writing The Haunting of Hill House, like An Adventure from 1911, a work related to the idea of, yes, time slips. You know, another work that incorporates the science fictional element of the time slip is a current work that responds to Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House. I'm talking about the 2023 novel A Haunting on the Hill by Elizabeth Hand. That is a work I have the great delight of teaching right now. FYI, A Haunting on the Hill is the very first work authorized by Shirley Jackson's estate to respond to Shirley Jackson's work. In effect, Shirley Jackson's estate, representatives of it, approached Elizabeth Hand, and with good reason. Elizabeth Hand has, among many other awards, won not one, but three Shirley Jackson Awards. Awards for outstanding achievement in the literature of psychological suspense, horror, and dark fantasy. They approached her and invited her to respond to Shirley Jackson's work, specifically The Haunting of Hill House. And what Elizabeth Hand has done is written not a pastiche, not a work that attempts to take on Shirley Jackson's voice and create a straight-up sequel, but instead she has written an Elizabeth Hand novel that takes up the character of Hill House with a whole new set of characters 60 years after the events depicted in The Haunting of Hill House, and created a love letter not just to The Haunting of Hill House, but also to Shirley Jackson's other works and her whole oeuvre, if you will. I have been intrigued to see the science fictional elements that appear in this work. Time slips being one of them. Another is the trope of missing time or lost time. When a place or an actor somehow seems to influence the way that time works. This is a trope that is often seen in accounts of or fictional works built around the idea of, for example, UFO sightings and alien abductions. I tend to immediately think, when I think of missing time or lost time, of the television series The X-Files, which used this trope to very good effect. And you know, that's not a coincidence, because Elizabeth Hand, the author of A Haunting on the Hill, also wrote the novelization for The X-Files Fight the Future, the 1998 film. In fact, although I associate Elizabeth Hand immediately with her award-winning genre works that have brought her multiple Nebula Awards and World Fantasy Awards and Shirley Jackson Awards, among others, she has also written a number of genre-related tie-in works. For example, she wrote the novelization of the film 12 Monkeys. She wrote four Star Wars tie-in works in the now Legends, that is, extra-canonical or non-canonical series, the Boba Fett series. And she wrote the Millennium novel, The Frenchman, tied into the television series Millennium. Very near and dear to my heart, I teach Millennium in my course on the Gothic tradition. And there, again, is Elizabeth Hand. So perhaps I can, sort of through the side door here, work in a bit of a biography of Elizabeth Hand. I'm going to put my cards on the table right now. I have mentioned before many times, as a historian, most of my favorite people are dead, and they have been dead for a long time, often since before I was born. That said, I do try to read as much as I can in contemporary work and find new authors or new-to-me authors and follow authors I enjoy. There are a handful of authors who are really top-tier for me, insta-buys. As soon as they publish a new work, I want it in my eyes and my ears and my brain. I'm talking the Lois McMaster Bujold, Ken Liu tier of authors, and Elizabeth Hand is on that list for me. She was born in 1957. She is a U.S. author. Rather than asking what Elizabeth Hand has done, it's just easier to say, what hasn't she done? Her first short story, Prince of Flowers, was published in the Twilight Zone magazine, Rod Serling's Twilight Zone, in 1988. And her first novel, Winterlong, the first in the science fictional post-apocalyptic futuristic Winterlong trilogy, was published in 1990. Since then, she has published 20 novels, many standalone stories, some parts of series, and five collections of short fiction and essays. I've already mentioned her Nebula Awards and World Fantasy Awards and Shirley Jackson Awards. She's won others as well, including the James Tiptree Jr. Award, now the Otherwise Award, the Mythopoeic Award, the International Horror Guild Award, you name it. She is also, I should mention, a longtime reviewer and critic for the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, as well as the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Boston Review, Salon, and The Village Voice. Although she is alive today, writing works today, I think her work in particular is very much related to genre history, in part because of how steeped in genre history, and history full stop, her work actually is. A Haunting on the Hill is a great example because of the way she incorporates her deep knowledge and research of Shirley Jackson. But many of her works show this deep research and knowledge of the past, whether she's incorporating genre tropes or relating to earlier genre works or bringing real historical people into her stories. For example, her The Bride of Frankenstein, Pandora's Bride from 2007 is using as a springboard the classic film The Bride of Frankenstein from 1935. And she folds into her story real people like W.H. Auden and Christopher Isherwood. Her young adult time travel novel, Radiant Days from 2012, connects 1978 with 1870 and the poet Arthur Rimbaud. So, science fictional? Absolutely. Connected to a larger historical sensibility of storytelling? Absolutely. And Hand also inserts science fictional elements into works that are not, in a larger sense, science fictional across the board. So even when it doesn't look like it's science fiction, there's often science fiction ingredients there in the mix. I want to wrap up talking about Hand by mentioning, first of all, her four-book Cass Neary crime or mystery series. Cass Neary is the main character there. It starts with Generation Loss in 2007, and as of right now, it ends with The Book of Lamps and Banners in 2020, although with any luck, that's not where it ends, and we get more. And here again is an example of her work looking like one genre, but actually containing many. The Cass Neary series looks like crime or mystery and reads very well as crime or mystery, but there's also more to it. And here I'm going to quote from the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction entry on Elizabeth Hand, written by John Clute, who, by the way, is also Elizabeth Hand's partner. This goes, talking about the Cass Neary series, like this, quote, though at first seemingly non-fantastic, incorporates a growing sense of the significance of Neary's uncannily prescient response to damaged psyches in a damaged world, see precognition. A capacity, her first name in full is Cassandra, which it may be difficult to heed, but fatal not to. As the series progresses, her sense of damage extends to previsions of harm done to the planet itself. End quote. I'd like to mention three works of particular interest that I think set up A Haunting on the Hill, and while these are works of gothic fiction, they most certainly do, again, connect to science fiction in some key ways. I just want to give shout-outs to, first of all, her novel Waking the Moon from 1994. It won the James Tiptree Jr. Award, now the Otherwise Award, for encouraging the exploration and expansion of gender, and the 1996 Mythopoeic Fantasy Award for Best Adult Fantasy Work. I taught this work in my Dark Academia class. It's a terrific work that combines cultural anthropology and gender a sense of old religious orders with even older ones beneath them in rivalry and in conflict, the stories we tell about power and control. And I think it sets up very well the vibe of walking into something that is old, that has a history you're not aware of, realizing you are now part of a story that you weren't really prepared for. I'll give you here the quick description from the publisher. Quote, like all new students, Sweeney moves with caution at Washington, D.C.'s University of the Archangel and St. John the Divine. It is a strange place of brooding shrines and gleaming towers guarded by stone angels. For Sweeney, college is a time to experiment with sex, to explore new friendships. It is a time of freedom and discovery, until she makes the wrong discovery, end quote. The next I would mention as being particularly tied into the voice and themes of 2023's A Haunting on the Hill is 2015's Wilding Hall, which won the Shirley Jackson Award for Best Novella. It is a work of gothic horror and domestic gothic in that it is tied uniquely to a house, to a place. It's also deeply tied, like A Haunting on the Hill, to music and creativity and performance. Here, as in later in A Haunting on the Hill, Elizabeth Hand's connection to historical murder ballads really shines through, and to folk horror, and the connection between folk music and folk horror. Here is the official description of Wilding Hall. Quote, when the young members of a British acid folk band are compelled by their manager to record their unique music, they hole up at Wilding Hall, an ancient country house with dark secrets. There they create the album that will make their reputation, but at terrifying cost. Julian Blake, the group's lead singer, disappears within the mansion and is never seen or heard from again. Now, years later, their surviving musicians, along with their friends and lovers, including a psychic, a photographer, and the band's manager, meet with a young documentary filmmaker to tell their own versions of what happened that summer. But whose story is true? And what really happened to Julian Blake? End quote. Lastly, I recommend a short story called For Sale by Owner. That appears in Ellen Datlow's edited When Things Get Dark, Stories Inspired by Shirley Jackson from 2021. And here you can see Elizabeth Hand working in Shirley Jackson's vibe before A Haunting on the Hill. This is a haunted house story, too. It's about this unique house that's always for sale, it seems. And it works on a psychological level, as these middle-aged women who are friends decide to take a look inside. And in fact, hey, why not spend the night there as a sort of camp out just to vicariously live in this really cool house for just a few hours. And, well, they'll never forget that experience. The house, you see, is just wrong. Not unlike Hill House itself. Okay, so I have done a woefully inadequate job of singing the praises of Elizabeth Hand, but I do hope you will check out her work if you are not familiar with it, and if you are familiar with it, well, go read some more. If you are looking for straight-up science fiction, I would recommend starting with either the Winterlong books, which were published between 1990 and 1993 for a good futuristic post-apocalyptic setting, or her anthology Saffron and Brimstone from 2006, which includes some science fiction stories that are quite good. Together they are Lost Domain, Four Story Variations. Again, that was in Saffron and Brimstone, Strange Stories, collected in 2006. I have really enjoyed talking about some of the ideas and tropes and authors I've been teaching, and I look forward to joining you again soon. I have some very different, all new topics up my sleeve for future Looking Back on Genre History segments, and I look forward to sharing them with you when we get together to take another look back on genre history. Thank you.
And there you go. There you go. Amy. Just get all kind of, yes, thank you. Man, just keep doing it there and just kind of keep putting these out. Thank you so much indeed. Well, that's it. That's it. Bedtime for me there. No, it's not. It's only 11:30 in the morning. So, yes, dog's out, dog's walked, all sorted. I'm going to have a little cup of tea. Until next time, just like to say, good night from me.
Thank you for listening.
Anytime soon, can you reach me? Is my signal getting through? Turn on your radio, I wanna talk to you. This signal's going light speed. By the time I get my say, I might already be on to you and on my way. But you're so far from here, and at best I'm moving slow. So I'm waiting on your call at home with nowhere to go. Can you reach me? Is my signal getting through? Turn on your radio, I wanna talk to you. I wanna talk to you. Cast myself on a radio wave, I might get to you someday. If books were rocket ships, I'd need only the will to fly. I'm still building word by word, and I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.